I begin our sermon today with an announcement. You probably already know Carrie had her baby. Carrie and Dan yesterday. Yeah. A little girl that is still nameless as far as I know. But we're so excited, and she seems totally well. Elizabeth Gaskell wrote novels about the social aspects of life in the mid-19th century in England, around the same time as Charles Dickens. The daughter and wife of pastors, she was concerned for the social conditions of her day, especially the kind of suffering that seemed that so many people endured. Her novel, North and South, which was actually given its name by Charles Dickens, who edited it and published it in 20 different installments in a periodical, is centered around the northern English city of Manchester and also around the growing tensions between workers and factory owners in that industrial age. She writes about a workers' strike, something, by the way, that Dickens wouldn't do. He was afraid of offending owners, but she took it head on. From that novel comes this line: loyalty and obedience to wisdom and justice are fine, but it is still finer to defy arbitrary power unjustly and cruelly used, not on behalf of ourselves, but on behalf of others more helpless. The plight of workers was especially turbulent in the early 1900s, a situation captured by the news of the time and by authors such as Upton Sinclair. Many strikes marked the industrial landscape, sometimes involving hundreds of thousands of workers. And you know, in our own time, some of these tensions have come to the fore again. I think partly because of the tentative economic situation that many people face around the globe. In 2011, over 1,500 factory workers in India took over a plant and occupied it for 2 weeks. It's said that they carried out a number of violent acts against their bosses and even some workers who wouldn't participate in the strike. So they held their ground for a fortnight, all the while negotiating with the government and threatening further violence. Why mention these things? Simply to give us a framework to know that these are not new situations. Jesus tells a parable that draws from labor tensions of his own time. Not to teach about workers' rights, although some do that with it, but to say the most important thing about himself that we hear him saying in the Gospel of Matthew. So we're looking at this parable today in Matthew 21. It's important to know that it's Holy Week. Jesus is in Jerusalem, just days from his betrayal and suffering and death, and he's teaching in the temple. And as he teaches, the circle of his critics is widening. We can imagine him surrounded by listeners, with the curious, those who just are sort of flocking to see what it's all about, with those who are devoted to him, but especially those who are troubled and threatened by his message. The Pharisees, the scribes, the Herodians, that's a political party, the Sadducees, members of the Sanhedrin, the kind of the ruling council. It would be like today having the theologians, the senior pastors, the leaders of the parachurch ministries, and the Christian college presidents, etc., all lined up to take their shot at him. They come to debate this itinerant preacher who didn't graduate from their programs and who does not have proper credentials that they would recognize. But the people, the common folk, the ones that didn't go to seminary, they responded to his message of God's love. They responded to the healing that he brought. They responded to the transformation that they were beginning to sense was going on. They clung to him in hope of the kingdom that he preached. And while he's debating these religious leaders, he tells three parables. The one we heard last week about the sons who were asked to go and work in the vineyard, and all the little things that Amanda helped us to know about the fear of missing out, FOMO, and all of that. I thought it was clever. It was great. The parable today, which sits in the middle of the three, also about a vineyard, and then the one we will hear next week. So we are taking all of these on. We're just doing that sort of sequentially. Only three parables appear in all three synoptic gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, Luke. And this is one of them. The other two are the parable of the sower and the parable of the mustard seed. So there's something about this that really is key and very important. It's important partly because what it says about the church, about the new nation or people of God, but even more so because of what it claims about Jesus himself. Now, it's possible that some of this parable actually rests in real situations. We know that in Galilee, many of the farms were owned by foreigners, people who lived outside of the country. And often the workers were not properly compensated. And if they could take possession of the farm, if there was some way in which the owner died in his residence somewhere way far away, they could make a legitimate claim that the farm was theirs. Of course, in this parable, that dynamic is turned on its head, with the workers mistreating the landowner, if you will, with arbitrary, unjust, and cruel power, as Elizabeth Gaskell called it. But the backdrop, this kind of situation, was probably not unknown to Jesus' hearers. It would have touched something that they could have said, oh, I get that, some of it at least. And the imagery of the vineyard is situated all across Israel's story. It's saturated with it. I want to read to you a few verses from Isaiah chapter 5. Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. So Jesus begins this parable, you might think, with the text of Isaiah in his hands. And in those verses here in Isaiah, we find judgment against the vineyard because of injustice and the lack of righteousness. Well, there's a lot of injustice in the vineyard of the parable, too. The one we have before us today. The workers, instead of giving the owner what is due, attack his representatives, finally killing his son. Ultimately, it's taken from them and given to others. It's a word of judgment to the religious leaders of the day, but it's also a word of encouragement for those who seek to follow Jesus and be faithful to him. I'd like to underline those encouragements today, without ignoring the warning that's there for us too. First in the parable, we see the long-suffering love of God. I mean, sometimes we jump right to the conclusion of the parable, but let's not miss what Jesus is saying about this landowner. As the harvest drew near, he sends representatives to receive what is his due. It's totally right. It's the rent that they owe. And instead, these representatives, these servants of the landowner, were met with beatings and murder and stoning. Now, the people listening to Jesus who were hearing this would have expected that to be the end of the story. It's done. Because the landowner would come and deal with the situation harshly. And you know what? That would be just and that would be right. Instead, what does he do? He sends other servants, and they receive the same fate. Who is patient like this? Who sends a second set of emissaries when the first ones are killed and abused? Well, either someone who's just dumb, or a landowner who is patient and kind and wanting to provide every opportunity for the wicked to make the right move. You know, after the giving of the Ten Commandments, the people are afraid. They see all the fireworks and all the show, and they trembled with fear, and they wanted to keep as much distance as possible between themselves and this terrifying divinity. And they tell Moses, no, you do the pastor thing, you go do the God thing. Keep us, we're not going near that. Moses comforts him. He says, don't be afraid. God has come to test you, to keep you from sinning. One translation says, God has come to prove you. That is, God has come to show you who you really are. His mercy and grace and long suffering prove us. They help us to know that we are His and that we are called to a life that's pleasing to Him. Through His mercy, that's what we desire. As the psalm says, it revives us, it gives us light, and it causes us to rejoice. We desire His judgments or His proving more than gold. In the parable, we see the long-suffering nature of the landlord, and we know that it's the story of God and God's character. One commentator said it should be called the parable of the many sendings. See, He had given responsibility to those He trusted, and they had abused their power, and in response, He shows tremendous restraint, patience, and love. Now, that's not the only theme, of course, because the theme that plays against that theme is the sinfulness of the tenant workers. See, they just didn't kill one set of the owner's representatives and say, oh, sorry, it was a mistake. They kill the other envoys. And eventually the landlord's own son, thinking somehow they could wrest ownership into their greedy hands. God's love always seems to find opposition. In fact, it sets itself against opposition. As Frederick Dale Bruner wrote about this parable, and I like what he had to say, he says that the main theme of the gospel is the love of God. Then the sub-theme of the gospel is humanity's rebellious response to this love. Apparently, we want to be God. We want to be the landowner. There's a dual theme of divine love and human sin that runs through the scriptures, and we find it starkly presented here in just a couple of verses. Moses said the fear of God was to keep the people from sinning, but sin continues, and we know this all too well. In this way, the parable echoes a passage from 2 Chronicles 36 that reads like this. The Lord, the God of their ancestors, sent persistently to them by His messengers again and again because He had compassion on His people and on His dwelling place. But they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising His words and scoffing at His prophets. In their sin, the vineyard workers kill the son, the one the landowner thinks they will respect and honor. But they've betrayed the trust He placed in them, because this is their nature. This is who they are. This is who we are without Him. When He finishes telling the parable, Jesus looks at all of them that are kind of, you know, gathered around Him, and He says to His opponents, okay, then tell me, what should the landowner do? Oh, they said, that's easy. He should put those tenants to a miserable death and rent it out to others who will give him his share. And with their own words, they put the finishing touch on the parable. And it points directly at them. And in Jesus' response, we find another and actually the most central theme, that Jesus Himself is the landowner's son. He's confronting the religious leaders with his identity and with what he knows they would like to do to him. In hearing his words in the parable, we're reminded that God affirmed Jesus at his baptism and in his transfiguration as my beloved son, my son. And then he quotes Psalm 118 about the stone that was rejected by the builders becoming the cornerstone because of what God did, the work that God does. See, these leaders knew exactly what Jesus was saying. He put it in a parable and then twisted it. He was making a personal claim about his identity as God's son, and also about God's rejection of them. I know sometimes people say, I've even heard scholars in my own seminary days say, well, Jesus never really claimed to be God's son. That's something the church did later. Well, he does here. He does here. Soon, these leaders would carry out what they planned to do to him. But in this moment, they are speechless, fearful of the crowds that for now, at least, were on his side. But not for long. I think there's a way in which this parable is central to the message of Matthew. Even though it comes kind of later in the book, all that has come before has been leading up to this, the claim that he is indeed God's son. Jesus sketches God's dealings with Israel in kind of a salvation history in this parable, and he places himself in the climax of the story. They know what he's saying, and they want to kill him for it. And as Jesus goes to the cross, soon after this confrontation, there's a great cosmic transformation that's set in motion. A new kingdom is underway. It's the ancient people of God, now the new people of God. The people of God's covenant renewed and called forward. A nation of Jews and Gentiles that would bear fruit. Israel was the center of God's mission to the world, but they were not the only heirs of the kingdom. The prophets had already announced this over and over. God's people, his vineyard, would have his law on their hearts. They would know the Lord through the work of the Messiah, through his death, resurrection, and exaltation, through his life. And the good news is that we are now invited to this nation, to this people, grafted in, able to know salvation through Christ. Able to be fruitful. You know, this isn't just a lesson for the Pharisees and the leaders of his own day. I think there's a probing question in this for us as well. The good news, but then kind of something we need to deal with and be honest about. And the question for me is this: how are we caring for the gifts that God has given us? What kind of tenants are we with the riches that we've received? See, many in Israel had been unfaithful, especially the leaders. Jesus said the inheritance was taken from them. But God is patient, compassionate, loving, kind, but God also calls us to be faithful. Paul says in Philippians, basically, I don't take it for granted, he says. I continually seek to move forward, to grow, to press on, to gain the prize. Would God remove from us the vineyard he has given if we don't tend it well or bear fruit? Are we presuming on his kindness? Are we doing all we can to work while it's day because we love the landowner? See, like the landowner of the parable, God extends his love and his patience to us over and over again, calling us, inviting, persuading us to respond. And in the end, it's only his mercy that makes our move toward him possible. Still, we must move. It's your kindness that leads to repentance, we're told in the Psalms. And it's in repentance and trust that fruit is able to flower. I once had a good friend that coached football at a pretty highly competitive level. He was a head coach in college, Division I. I don't use a lot of football analogy, you know, stories, so you better listen in on this one. And he had tremendous qualities. He was a very committed Christian, and he had tremendous leadership qualities, but he did many things with his team that were unseen. He had some of the highest graduation rates in the NCAA. And he also made players room together who were of different races and backgrounds to bring unity, to bring racial reconciliation. But he didn't have enough wins. And so his team was taken from him and given to another. God does not measure like that. I think some of us think that. Some of us have experience, or we've allowed ourselves to be shaped by experiences that say, well, yeah, that we figure, you know, and if we don't have enough wins, if we can't, you know, kind of produce it the way we think it ought to be, then God's going to do something, you know, judge us in some way. But see, God measures how we do it. God is concerned for how we treat one another. God is concerned about the way in which we go about doing the work of his kingdom. Because ultimately, the fruit is his work, right? He gives the increase. We just say yes, and we lean in. So today we celebrate and give thanks for the patient love of God, even though we know our sin. We affirm that Jesus is the Christ, that it's really about him. And we also say thanks be to God that we're called now to be in his kingdom, to be about his work. Let's be fruitful. Let's be open to what he's doing through us. Amen.